A cyborg is a biological organism that has been enhanced in some way by a mechanical device, a hybrid of human and machine. A musical cyborg is kind of the same thing, and if you think about it, you've been listening to cybernetic music all your life. Welcome to Strong Songs, a podcast about music. I'm your host, Kirk Hamilton, and I'm so glad that you've joined me to talk about music made by cyborgs, music made for cyborgs, music made with cyborgs, and music made about cyborgs. Okay, the word has lost all meaning. This show is Patreon supported, entirely independent, and I get to make it however I want, and that's all thanks to you for supporting me as I make it. To support this 100% human-made podcast, go to patreon.com/strongsongs. On this episode, it's time for me to step aside and let you pick the topic, and oh, what a topic you picked. The results of our first ever voting bracket are coming right up, and there's so much to talk about. So, let's plug in the drum machine, sync up the synths, and drop the beat. Disco, disco, disco. For a word that for decades was almost considered a slur by fans of some other styles of music, it sure is a fun one to say. And speaking of that, Blondie. Blondie, 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 Blondie. You know, that's a pretty fun word to say, too. Disco and Blondie. Two fun words that somehow sound even more fun together. Maybe we should look into that. As I was beginning pre-production on Strong Song Season 6, I held my first ever listener voting bracket to have listeners vote on an artist for me to cover in the upcoming season. We started with 32 different artists ranging from Cyndi Lauper to Ella Fitzgerald, and everyone on Patreon got a vote. Several rounds and many votes later, it all came down to an unlikely showdown between two very different bands. On the one hand, Nirvana, and on the other hand, Blondie. To be honest, I really thought Nirvana was gonna pull it out. They had been dominant in every round leading up to the finals. That said, there'd already been a lot of surprises, so I'd learned to expect the unexpected, and only a few hours after voting opened, it became clear that a winner was in the offing. Yes, Blondie cruised to victory, which meant that it was time for me to choose one of their songs to break down on the show. And while I listened to a ton of their music before making my decision, in the end, I mean, you knew which song it was going to be. On this episode, I am so excited to talk about Blondie and their 1978 hit, Heart of Glass. This is a great example of a song that I thought I knew, but when I sat down with it, I discovered layer upon layer of fascinating production and songwriting techniques that I hadn't noticed before. With Heart of Glass, an unusually well-documented writing and recording process led to a one-of-a-kind song that took Blondie from the clubs of the New York underground to dance floors around the world. First up, some vital stats. Blondie was fronted by now famous singer Debbie Harry, but as she and the rest of the band took great pains to remind people, she was not Blondie. Blondie was the band, which also consisted of guitarist Chris Stein, drummer Clem Burke, synth and keyboard player Jimmy Destri, bassist Nigel Harrison, and guitarist Frank Infante. Blondie was a great band, and you can hear their influence on all sorts of rock bands today. They sound very modern, even though they were making the bulk of their material so many decades ago. But Heart of Glass, which was the breakout single off of their 1978 album Parallel Lines, that was actually a little bit of a stylistic outlier for them as a pure dance number. One way or another. They've got plenty of other hits to their name that give a sense of their style and the breadth of their music. One Way or Another off of Parallel Lines is a great one. One way or another, I'm gonna see ya. There's also Atomic, which is off of their 1979 follow-up to Parallel Lines' Eat to the Beat. That's my other favorite Blondie song, and it's the one I almost wound up focusing on for this episode. Really, just so I could talk about this part. Atomic rules. Definitely go listen to that song if you've never heard it before. Their other most famous song, Call Me, is actually only sort of a Blondie song. Harry only wrote the lyrics, with the song itself written by Giorgio Moroder for the American Gigolo soundtrack, and the other members of the band were actually replaced by LA session musicians on the original version. Great song, though. Heart of Glass was a huge hit for Blondie, and in the wake of that song, you can hear a little more of those dance grooves making their way into their songs, but even now, Heart of Glass sticks out a bit when you put it up against the rest of their more sharp-elbowed new wave rock tunes. And that's also what makes the song interesting. Like a lot of Blondie songs, it was written by Debbie Harry and guitarist Chris Stein, but it sounded quite a bit different in its original incarnation. After Heart of Glass became a hit, Blondie released this early demo they had recorded of the song back when it was called Once I Had a Love, and which they hadn't quite found a home for or worked into a finished state. As you can hear, it was pretty different. It was a slower, kind of jammier thing. It had this like quasi-reggae bounce to it. Some of the band members apparently referred to it semi-ironically as the disco song. Parallel Lines was produced by Mike Chapman, a now legendary producer and songwriter who worked as a bit of a hitmaker. The guy knew how to make a killer record. According to Harry, in a 2013 interview with The Guardian that I'll link in show notes, Chapman was listening to the songs the band had ready for their new record, and once they'd gotten through them all, he asked, "Have you got anything else?" So they played him this song, and he saw the song's potential. He and the band quickly set about transforming that raw material into what would eventually become Heart of Glass, and they did so with the help of some, at the time, cutting-edge instruments and production techniques. So as you can hear, they had quite a ways to go to get from that demo to the finished song, and they've talked a lot about that process over the years. There's this great 2008 Sound on Sound article that goes in depth with Chapman on how they put the whole thing together. There are a variety of other articles and interviews and features about this song out in the world, but I'm primarily going to be referencing that article, which I'll link in the show notes. First up, they quickly dropped that whole skunky reggae vibe and they tried different feels for the song. He says they tried a traditional rock feel, but that wasn't really working. So he pulled a classic producer trick and he asked Debbie Harry, "All right, what music is turning you on right now?" Her answer, according to him, was Donna Summer, which they all had to acknowledge was disco and set them on the path toward this song's disco inflections, despite the fact that several of the band members had an antipathy for disco, which was pretty common in the late 70s among rock fans. Of course, Chapman and Harry had both heard Donna Summer. They knew that disco could actually be pretty great, so they set about turning Once I Had a Love into a disco song, albeit one with a Blondie twist. They soon changed the title to Heart of Glass, which is a much better title, and they arranged the song around a new driving rhythm anchored by a crucial piece of electronic music gear, a Roland CR78 drum machine. Happily, the recording actually begins with a couple of bars of the CR78 playing one of its standard grooves unaccompanied, so I could grab that and use it for my recreation rather than having to track down an emulation of the machine or find a recording of it somewhere. I do like to strive for authenticity, and this is an easy way to get it. The drum machine is playing this jaunty little groove that's actually got a little bit of salsa to it. It's defined by a 3-2 clave figure. Ba, 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 ba. With one exception, this drum machine pattern plays through the entire recording. It's over on the left channel, just cooking away the entire time. And the band used the drum track as a guidepost for the song, similarly to how a band today might use a click track, with the difference being that the CR78 was actually included in the finished recording. Ordinarily, a click track is more of an auxiliary track that plays a metronome click through the band's headphones, allowing them to keep a groove consistent, which makes it easier to overdub and edit after the fact since the tempo remains constant across every take. Click tracks have become the norm in music today, particularly in pop music, as MIDI sequencing has allowed the synchronization of dozens of electronic instruments across an entire studio, and quantization and rhythmic redistribution of parts after they've been recorded is also possible thanks to digital audio software. In the late 70s, that was a much less widespread practice, particularly for rock bands like Blondie. So, using the drum machine as a guide, Burke recorded each of his drum parts separately. First, he recorded the kick drum, that four-on-the-floor dance thump, carefully performed so that it matched perfectly with the downbeat of each bar. Next came the snare drum, keeping metronomic time on 2 and 4, giving the most straightforward thump-pop juxtaposition possible. Finally came the cymbals, the hi-hat and the crash cymbal, filling out the groove with a subdivided sizzle defined by a washy, half-open disco hi-hat thing. So that's the thump, the pop, and the sizzle, and it's all really straightforward. If that was all there was to the groove on this song, it wouldn't sound as interesting as it does. To me, those drums are just a supporting structure for the elements that Chapman and the band used to bring this groove to life. The keyboard, the bass synth, and the electric guitars. Those are all harmonic instruments, so before we get into them, let's go over the harmony of this verse really quick. Heart of Glass is in the key of E major, or at least this recording is. Blondie tends to perform the song live in D. They were even doing that way back in the 1970s in some televised performances, so I'm not sure if they recorded it in D and sped it up to raise the pitch. It doesn't really sound like that to me. Regardless, it is squarely in E on the record, and so we are going to do it in the key of E major. The three chords of the verse are E major first, which then goes to a C sharp major chord, which is a nice little lifted sound that then shifts to C sharp minor, which is a more traditional place for the sixth chord to be, before going back to E major. So it's just those three chords, E major, C sharp major, C sharp minor, E major. So those are the chords that everyone is playing. Let's build this one up from the bottom. So we've already got the drums and the drum machine sorted. Those are pretty straightforward. That means we need to add the bass. The thing is, Heart of Glass doesn't just have Nigel Harrison's electric bass part. It's also got this repeating synth bass firing out 16th notes throughout the entire song. So Harrison's bass line is pretty simple. He plays these strong E downbeats, surrounds it with an F sharp and a B, and that's basically the pattern. Pretty straightforward, but there's also this bass synth, a Roland SH-1000 that was matched to the drum machine, so it just sat there spitting out 16th notes like this. Alright, let's add the electric bass to that. So let's add the drums to that, and we should be getting somewhere. It's really all about those robotic 16th notes provided by the drum machine and its paired synth. So when you mix in the other instruments played by humans, the result is this beguiling musical cyborg. It's like watching a robot join a human family for dinner. It's a little odd, but it works. So with the bass in there, our cybernetic musical superstructure is getting closer to completion. Let's keep on going with those guitar parts played by Chris Stein and Frank Infante. So there are two primary guitar parts in the studio version of Heart of Glass. There's the most obvious one, that syncopated octave riff that you can hear over on the right. And then there's this more unusual one that I'm pretty sure is a guitar, though it sounds almost like a synthesizer. It's this repeating delayed part. In some ways, it mirrors that repeating Roland bass synth. So to get that sound, I cranked up the feedback dial on my digital delay, which caused the delay to just ring out almost infinitely. I then played a single very short note on the guitar, and the delay pedal did the rest. So while I do think this sound is a guitar, the human being is only providing the very first note, and the majority of the sound production is coming from that delay pedal. So again, this guitar part is a mix of human and automated music. Now, I'm not actually sure who played which guitar part here. In that Sound on Sound interview, Chapman mentions putting Chris Stein's guitar through a repeating effect, which makes me think that Stein is playing those layered, delayed, single note parts. Chapman also says that Infante was by far the most capable technical player in the band, which, along with what I can glean from watching some live performances recorded around the time they released their record, makes me think that Infante was the one playing the lead riff over on the right, particularly given the fact that later on in the song, that part actually gets more involved and technical than I would have thought just based on my surface level knowledge of this song. This was a fun riff to learn how to play. It's not complicated just in terms of how many notes it has, but you can get into a real groove with it once you start playing. That lead guitar part plays an important role in the overall arrangement. It's the most identifiably human element of the band. If you take it out, you're left with a more regimented, somewhat electronic-sounding dance track. Add that electric guitar part back in, and it gives just a little bit more rock. So that's the rhythm section sorted. Now it's time for the final crucial element of any Blondie song, Debbie Harry's lead vocals. I love how Debbie Harry sounds on this song. It's an instantly recognizable vocal performance that's partly due to how she sang it and partly due to how it was recorded. I wanted to talk about it and, well, I decided to try to demonstrate the vocals myself. And while it was fun to sing it and it sounds fine in its way, I can't say that it sounds quite right. So I decided it was time to call in a favor. Caitlin and Lori Shook, also known as the Shook Twins, are an incredible songwriting duo out of my hometown of Portland, Oregon. I've known them for many years now. I've written and played horn arrangements for them on stage and on a few of their records. I asked if they'd be down to come by and sing the lead part for you all, and they were into it.
Once I had a love and it was a guess. Soon turned out had a heart of glass.
Now that's more like it. Now far be it from me to suggest that a male voice in its high head voice can't perform a song originally sung by a woman. We did just talk about Jack White's cover of Jolene after all. But there are a couple of particular things about the vocals on this song that I think the Shooks will make easier and more fun to highlight. To start with, this vocal part has a distinct, almost diaphanous quality. It shimmers and shines in this slightly unnatural way. It actually embodies the title of the song. When I hear Debbie Harry sing Heart of Glass, in my mind's eye, I see a heart of glass. Harry is singing pretty high in her vocal range. She's mostly in her head voice, which is the term for that lighter voice up here, as opposed to your chest voice, which is down here. Most singers sing in some kind of a mix between those two different resonances, and sometimes head voice is called falsetto. I actually think it's more helpful to think of head and chest as two different resonances rather than two different voices, because it's all just your one voice. So I think of them as head resonance and chest resonance. So when a singer goes way up high like this, they're mostly singing in their head resonance. So here's Lori singing that same lead part from the opening verse up in her head voice, mimicking how Debbie Harry sang the part.
Once I had a love and it was a guess. Soon turned out, had a heart of glass.
Call it head voice, head resonance, falsetto, whatever you call it, that light upper register vocal sound is a defining sound of disco. Think Chic, the Bee Gees, modern acts like the Scissor Sisters. That vocal sound is everywhere, and that's what Debbie Harry is evoking here. Now, there's something else going on as well. Harry's light singing style is supported by a production technique, the fact that all of her lead vocals have been doubled. She recorded everything twice, which adds a slight warbling chorus effect to the lead part and makes it sound slightly unnatural. Now, ordinarily, I'd try to copy that doubling technique by having the lead vocalist sing the lead part twice, but since I had the Shook Twins in the studio, I realized I had an opportunity to try something a little more fun. See, Caitlin and Lori are identical twins, and one reason they're able to sing so beautifully together is that they've spent many years, their whole lives really, working out interesting ways to blend and differentiate their voices. So first, Lori recorded the lead part.
Once I had a love and it was a guess.
And then Caitlin matched her.
Once I had a love and it was a guess.
Put them together and we get a really nice sounding take on Harry's original doubled vocal part.
Guess. Soon turned out, had a heart of glass.
The Shooks and I spent a whole morning really drilling down into Harry's specific approach to phrasing, which was a lot of fun. When all was said and done, I asked them what they thought of the process. Just for your reference, Lori's on the left and Caitlin is on the right.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting to try to dissect everything and match her, like, sweetness. She has, like, a sweetness to her voice, I thought.
But also gnarliness.
Sweet gnarly.
and just the phrasing. Once I got in here, we started dissecting every little nuance of how she rushes the two and holds onto that O a little bit longer. I singing along with it and just listening to it over and over again before we came in here. I didn't even pay attention to any of those because it just felt so natural listening to her, how it came out of her mouth.
So let's go a little bit deeper on how Harry phrased that opening verse, and I think you'll see what Caitlin was talking about there. Take that opening line, once I had a love and it was a gas. When the Shooks and I recorded it, we quickly realized that there are 1,000 different ways to sing that line. Harry does something pretty specific with the very opening of the phrase. She holds on the W sound in once. Once, which causes the line to sort of sneak into being. Listen for it in the original recording. You hear that? She sort of sneaks in on it, and it's unusual for a singer to hold on something like wuh as opposed to an open vowel. It gives it a very particular sound. An opening phrase like that is very important since it's the first part of the melody that the listener hears. So it's subtle what she's doing, but it's crucial for the overall effect of the song, and it took us a few takes to get it right. Like, here's an early take of Lori singing it with the once a little stronger on the downbeat, which sounds great, but just doesn't quite match how Debbie Harry sang it.
Once I had a love and it was a gas.
Compare that to a later take where she stretched out the W sound on once.
Once I had a love and it was a guess.
So we're going from
once I had a love
to
once I had a love.
It's a fine distinction, but those fine distinctions really add up. When you put them all together, eventually you get a distinct musical performance like the one that Debbie Harry gave on this song. The second half of the phrase is equally specific. It's easy to stretch out that closing line, had a heart of glass. But Harry hits it and quits it. To me, it's an unsentimental way of singing the line.
Soon turned out, had a heart of glass.
It's a pretty straightforward one to sing, though.
Soon turned out, had a heart of glass.
The next phrase after that one seemed like the real thing, only to find it's got a lot going on. It's easy to just let that line kind of pass you by, since that's just the second half of the first verse of Heart of Glass. You've heard it before, it sounds great, but that's just how the song goes. But Debbie Harry didn't have to sing it that way, and in fact, she didn't always sing it that way. Listen to the same line in that earlier demo when the song was still called Once I Had a Love. She puts it right on the downbeat. Seem like the real thing. Just super straightforward, as straightforwardly as you can sing that phrase. Seem like the real thing, only to find. Now compare that with the way that she sang it in the finished version of Heart of Glass. Seem like the real thing, only to find. So it's got bounce, it's got energy, and that's because she syncopates the opening part of the line, seemed like the real thing. She moves the phrase to the upbeats, which gives the whole thing a rhythmic lilt right off the bat. A 2, 3, 4.
Seem like the real thing, only to find. Seem like the real thing, only to find.
And then there are those extra notes at the end of the phrase. Instead of singing it the way she originally sang it, only to find, and ending on the G sharp.
Seem like the real thing, only to find.
She holds the word find and keeps going down that C sharp major triad. Only to find, which really emphasizes the sound of that C sharp major chord, which, like I said, it's an unusual chord to have a 6 major there, and the melody really brings that out. As a result, the harmony is in the melody, by which I mean they've rewritten the melody to include more notes from the underlying chords, so if you listen to the melody sung a cappella with nothing underneath it, you can still hear the chords as they're going by.
Seem like the real thing, only to find.
The final line of the first verse is just pretty funny. She sings, mucho mistrust, love's gone behind. And that's just not a lyric that I'd ever heard or read before, and I just kind of think it's funny.
Mucho mistrust, love's gone behind.
It does emphasize an interesting difference between the lyrics of the verses of Heart of Glass and the lyrics of the choruses. The verses are a little more conversational and they're a little more casual in tone, while the choruses have a more elevated, poetic tone, especially the second chorus. And this is actually an unusual song in that several of the verses repeat lyrics, but the choruses actually each have different lyrics. Mostly I just think that mucho mistrust is a funny pairing of words and not one that I was expecting to hear in this song.
Mucho mistrust, love's gone behind.
So I want you to listen to the Shooks sing through that entire opening verse and just pay attention to each of those little nuances that we just talked about. Each one took a little bit of pinning down as we listened, recorded, listened back, compared, recorded again. It was a real process to get it to match up.
Once I had a love and it was a guess. Soon turned out, had a heart of glass. Seemed like the real thing, only to find. Mucho mistrust, love's gone behind. Was I love and it was a guess. Soon turned out, had a heart of glass.
Learning songs with this degree of reproductive precision is actually an unusual part of the Strong Songs process, and it's a way that making this show is different from learning a song in order to sing it yourself. It's actually usually better to adapt a song to your own voice and style rather than getting too in the weeds trying to recreate every little phrase and placement from the original. And it was eye-opening for me to have the Shooks come in and learn the song, since it really helped me understand that. Like Caitlin said,
I didn't even pay attention to any of those because it just felt so natural listening to her, how it came out of her mouth. But then when you start, like, oh, wow, it is very nuanced, and to try to match it perfectly is a challenge.
And it's not the natural things that come out of our mouth.
Right, yeah. Right, because she probably didn't have to put that much thought into it.
No, it just came out.
Because she just sang it,
yeah,
the way she sang it.
Totally.
Because she was the first one to sing
it. Yeah, and that's what singing's like, you know? It's like how you talk, how you phrase your talking, kind of, too.
One time love,
Okay, so let's go through that whole opening verse, listening first to the version I recorded with the Shooks, and then transitioning with open ears to the original, and try to take in everything that we've talked about so far. Those robotic, metronomic elements like the Roland drum loop and the repeating bass synth. The drums played by a human in the most robotic way that he could, the electric bass adding a human element to the existing robotic synth part, and the two electric guitar parts, one firing off echoing delay notes, and the other on a more traditional rock riff skipping along atop the groove. Over all of that structure, listen for Caitlin and Lori doubling that vocal lead, creating a shimmering, elevated vocal sound that pierces through the arrangement like a shard of, well, you know. All right, ears on, let's do it. The second verse is pretty much the same as the first, with one notable addition. Jimmy Destri's synthesizer makes an entrance over on the left channel, adding these scintillating, ethereal synth pads that further emphasize the song's glass-like quality. And with that, it's time for a disco-tastic transition into the chorus. Now, I love this chorus, and I apologize in advance for how firmly it's going to get stuck in your head while we talk about it. But before we talk about the chorus itself, I just want to call out the transitions into and out of the chorus. Infante and Harrison double this extremely silly octave bouncing disco riff on both sides. Listen for it in the recording. Now, I can't speak to anyone's state of mind when they recorded a given part, but it's hard not to hear that part as a kind of ironic jab at a disco cliche, since, remember, apparently several members of Blondie didn't really care for disco music, and they weren't thrilled to be making a song in that style. And that octave jumping thing, it's such a disco cliche. It's kind of to disco what this riff is to the blues. Or what this riff is to jazz. Every style of music has its cliches, and if you embrace the cliche enough, a certain level of irony kind of comes through. But regardless of how they intended it, these transitions kind of rule. Anyway, let's get into this chorus. A lot of the basic pulse remains unchanged. The hi-hat pattern's a little bit different, which does kind of tighten up the feel of the chorus, but broadly, it's a similar groove. So the chords here at the top of the chorus are bouncing back and forth between A major, the 4 chord, and E major, the 1 chord. Just A back to E a couple of times. The bass, bass synth, and repeater guitar all just play those roots with nothing more complex going on. The lead guitar and the lead synth are where things get a little bit more interesting. Both parts relate to the melody, and they combine with Debbie Harry's some melody to make this dense new sound that moves along on top of the rest of the band. So let's talk about that melody. The melody to the chorus of Heart of Glass is similar to the melody to the verse. It has this relaxed, sing-songy quality, and it is all about the sixth. Heart of Glass is pretty into the sixth in general. And by sixth, I mean the sixth scale degree. That scale degree plays an important part in the melody to this song. So in any key, you can count out the parent scale in terms of its numerical scale degrees. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8 is the octave. You can do that for any type of scale. That was a major scale. A basic triad goes 1, 3, and 5. In a major key, the sixth is one step above the fifth. So this song's verse begins in E major, and the melody begins way up on a C sharp, which is the sixth in that key. The chorus is in A, and the melody starts up on an F sharp, which is the sixth in the key of A. It moves through that phrase and then repeats the same notes over an E, which means it's starting on an F sharp still, which is the ninth in the key of E. It's a sound that's kind of floating and suspended in the same way that the sixth is. It's a very logical, orderly melody. I think that's actually one reason that it's so catchy, that it gets stuck so firmly in your head. So obviously, Debbie Harry is singing that melody, but the synth and the lead guitar are both doubling it in their own ways. The lead synth, which is over on the left, is doubling the melody in a pretty straightforward way. It's really just playing the melody. Now, the lead guitar part is actually pretty interesting and was one of the biggest surprises for me in learning this song. I never really noticed what the lead guitar was doing on the chorus to Heart of Glass. And again, I believe this is Infante, but I could be wrong about that. So while the verse guitar part was pretty simple, just a bunch of groovy octave riffs, the chorus guitar part is this much more complicated figure. It's this neat, very guitar-y double stop thing. It's a fairly technical guitar figure. It involves playing a double stop sixth, which, thanks to the tuning of the guitar, is actually pretty logical to play. If I slow it down, you can hear the two parallel lines in the double stop. This was fun to work out, and it's a clever part, especially how he lets those open A and E strings ring out underneath the pattern. In the context of the full recording, it kind of fades into the background, and he doesn't always play every note in the figure, but once you know what to listen for, it becomes a lot easier to hear. So that's the band sorted, which leaves us with the vocals. This vocal arrangement is split across two separate parts. There's the higher lead part, which is in the middle, and then, pan to the left and the right, there's a secondary part that sings down the octave. For the longest time, I actually thought that that secondary part was a male vocal, but if you listen closely, you can hear that it's actually Debbie Harry down in the very basement of her vocal register. Both the high and the low parts are doubled, with the low parts split apart and panned left and right. This lower part was a real stretch for Caitlin and Lori in terms of their vocal range, but Lori took it on, and I went ahead and jumped in as well to help out with some of the very lowest notes, and between us, we got a pretty close recreation of the chorus.
In between, what I find is pleasing and I'm feeling fine. Love is so confusing, there's no peace of mind. If I fear I'm losing you, it's just no good. You teasing like you do.
I really like how that vocal arrangement fits with the synth and the lead guitar parts, since each of those is playing some element of that melody. Listen to them isolated from the rhythm section and just pay attention for that, how the three parts together create this layered sense of the melody and how the instruments support the vocals.
In between, what I find is pleasing and I'm feeling fine.
It's pretty cool, right? It's a gentle melody, but that extra instrumentation adds a nice thickness to it.
If I feel I'm losing you, it's just no good. You're teasing like you do.
All right, so let's listen back to that chorus, first the recreation, then the original, and try to catch all of that, starting with that possibly ironic disco transition in the guitar and the bass into that slightly tweaked hi-hat pattern that tightens things up a little bit, the synth and that unexpectedly complex lead guitar part supporting Caitlin and Lori's vocal melody as it splits into a gentle octave doubling arrangement. Here we go.
So confusing, there's no peace of mind. If I fear I'm losing you, it's just no good. You're teasing like you do love.
I really like to listen to Debbie Harry over on the right and the left, down in her lower register.
Peace of mind. If I fear I'm losing you, it's just
she sounds so good.
You're teasing like you do love.
It's a killer 1-2 punch of a verse followed by a chorus, so after coming out of it for the first time, they circle around and do it again. In classic pop fashion, the second verse is half as long as the first verse, quickly transitioning to a second chorus that actually has different lyrics from the first chorus. And then the second chorus repeats as an odd meter instrumental. So to me, this second chorus is really where this song jumps to another level. It starts with those new lyrics sung over the same melody. And I love these new lyrics, and I love how Debbie Harry sings them. Lost inside, adorable illusion, and I cannot hide. I'm the one you're using, please don't push me aside. And then she just sort of tosses off the final phrase. We could have made it cruising, yeah. I love ending a phrase with yeah. I never think to do that as a songwriter, but I should. It's a great way to end a phrase.
We could have made it cruising.
There's just something really melancholy and beautiful about the way that she sings this chorus. It's a contrast to how Debbie Harry sang a lot of the time, but I really like this mode for her. The Shooks sang it in their own way, and I thought they sounded great as well.
Lost inside, adorable illusion, and I cannot hide. I'm the one you're using, please don't push me aside. We could have made it cruising, yeah.
And from there, the band takes over with this lovely instrumental section. It takes the basic chorus arrangement, removes the beat to put it in 7, and elaborates it into something just a bit more ornate. This instrumental section functions as a bridge, even though musically it's pretty similar to the chorus. But it makes enough subtle changes that I'm going to say it's functioning as a bridge. There should be a name for that. A chorus bridge hybrid. A cridge and a Boris. Neither of those sound quite right. I'll chew on it. I think we can come up with a term. Anyways, the first thing about this section is the odd meter. They drop a beat out of every 2-bar phrase, putting this section in a nice 7-4 time signature. Just count it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1. And they're back to 4-4 for the next section. And that's what's nice about 7-4 as opposed to 7-8. Since we've talked about 7 a little bit this season, it came up back on the episode about Black Hole Sun as well, and I do see people get 7-4 and 7-8 mixed up. I think I've actually been kind of casual about it at times on the show as well, or at least I should allow for that possibility, because sometimes I just say things are in 7 without specifying whether they're in 7-4 or 7-8. But this is actually a good way to tell the difference between the two. 7-4 keeps a steady downbeat pulse because the quarter note is still defining the beat, while 7-8 causes a stutter in the pulse. In 7-8, this section would be like da 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 1 2 1 2 1 2 3 1 2 1 2 1 2 3. It would be cool, but it would cause this skip in the groove that could cause an issue on the dance floor. There are plenty of great 7/8 dance traditions from around the world, but in disco, it's kind of all about that 4-on-the-floor heavy quarter note downbeat. Switching to 7/4 is a cool way to have a bit of a skip, a kind of a surprising rhythmic element without losing that downbeat pulse. There are really only two other new musical elements during this section. Jimmy Destri joins his synth part with an organ, which adds a playful bite to that melody. And Infante plays his coolest guitar part yet, taking the part that he played on the preceding choruses and jumping the whole thing up 12 frets so that it's ringing out up an octave, which turns out works the exact same, ringing open strings and all. It's such a good guitar part. I've seen a lot of guitar lessons online talking about how to play that basic verse riff, but more people should be talking about how to play the choruses on this song. It was a fun challenge trying to figure out how to play it and how to get it down. Thanks as always to my guitar teacher, Scott, for showing me a way to play it down and up the octave. And if you put that guitar part together with the synth and the organ, you get a nice rendition of the chorus melody. Add the rest of the rhythm section, and you are cooking. You hear that guitar part over on the right? They keep the nonverbal vibes going with a tossed-off, wordless vocal melody. It was actually sung not by any of the boys in the band, but by producer Mike Chapman. Before building to a breakdown. There are a lot of little things that I love about that second half of the bridge after they go back to 4/4 time. Chapman's vocals are perfect. They're kind of buried in the mix. It's this schmaltzy la 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 la. I just love how he sings it. Even before I knew it was him, it just doesn't sound very Blondie in a way that's kind of fun. Chapman is Australian, and I kind of feel like a little bit of his accent is coming through or something. Just for a minute, it kind of sounds like a different band. Infante is actually playing yet another new guitar part on this section. It's a more open, modified version of the lower part that he played on earlier choruses. It goes something like this. And then at the end of the phrase, building into the breakdown, he takes that disco cliche, that octave riff, and he plays both notes together, but he syncopates his guitar part so that he's playing upbeats to Harrison's bass downbeats. It's a little thing, but it's really cool, and it's emblematic of this guitar part overall and why it's such a crucial part of this recording. A significant percentage of Heart of Glass is automated and repetitive. The drum machine, the synth bass, the drums, but the guitar is resolutely human and ever-changing. So when this becomes this, you may not even notice it in the recording, but it's there, and it does matter. And I'll bet you'll notice it now. Here we go. The breakdown on Heart of Glass is great, and it's a textbook breakdown. First, Harry's vocals sneak in halfway through the preceding phrase, which creates a maximum contrast with the coming breakdown. So the first two bars of the breakdown are Heart of Glass at its most stripped down. Its most dramatic aspect is actually an absence. This is the one moment in the entire recording that the drum machine drops out. You might not think about it or consciously notice it, but its absence completely changes the feel of this part of the song. It's just the droning bass synth and the repeater guitar on the right and left, the hi-hat, and Harry's wordless vocals. Ooh, oh. Then comes a monster drum fill followed by the addition of the thumping kick drum, but no snare. Classic breakdown move. In fact, the textbook cut-and-paste nature of this breakdown helped me understand how important predictability is to dance music in general and why tropes like the breakdown into a layered reassembly are so prevalent in that style of music. When a crowd is dancing to a song, it really helps for the song to do the expected, since that keeps everyone in the groove and it gives them peaks and valleys around which to orient themselves. The dance breakdown is just one of a bunch of dance floor tropes like the drop or the riser, and I guarantee that all of the thousands or even millions of times that a group of people have been ripping it up to this song, this breakdown has created a similar moment in the crowd. So since I had the Shooks in the studio, I couldn't help but ask them to sing this part, and they did such a great job that I feel like I gotta let you hear them. So let's listen back to that whole section, the instrumental bridge with that organ on the melody and that higher jangly guitar part, then the chorus reprise with the male vocals tossing off a wordless melody while the guitar plays a third new part on that chorus chord progression into the breakdown as the band cuts out along with the drum machine and then steadily, predictably adds new elements until the groove is fully cooking once more. And of course, after the bridge, you'll hear the Shooks doing their thing. They actually recorded the oohs together as opposed to one after the other, which is how we recorded all of the other parts. It gives a good sense of just how well they can sing together in unison. All right, ears on, here we go. Instrumental on out, this song is just a party. Everyone's here, everyone's got something fun to do, the people are on the dance floor, so let's just keep it going. It has this easygoing reveler's energy, which is all the more remarkable given how much exacting, iterative work it took to actually put the song together. With the band back in, Blondie prepares to say goodbye with one final verse, albeit a verse with a playfully provocative new lyric. Apparently that pain in the ass lyric was a little bit of a sticking point for some radio stations that played this song back in the 70s. And really, that's about it. They came, they saw, we danced, and the song can end. Heart of Glass is a good reminder of how much work it can take to make something sound easy, and it was a fascinating preview of some of the production techniques that would become even more prominent in the 80s, into the 90s, into the modern digital era. Both a glimpse of the future and a moment in time as one of the great bands of the era first truly arrived. Thank you. And that'll do it for my analysis of Heart of Glass by Blondie. I hope you all enjoyed it. You picked it, after all. Thanks to everyone who voted in the bracket to pick this artist for this episode. That was so much fun. I can't believe it took me so long to do a bracket like that. We'll be doing another one over the summer to pick an artist for season 7. So if you'd like to participate in the voting, go become a patron. Patreon.com/strongsongs. Thanks also to Emily Williams for her production support this season, to Scott Pemberton for helping me work out some of those guitar parts, and extra special thanks to Caitlin and Lori Shook. What a treat to have singers of that caliber on the show. You should 100% go listen to their music. They record and tour as Shook Twins. They have a ton of albums and a new one in the works, and you can even hear me playing saxophone on a couple of them. I'll put a link to their stuff in the show notes. I continue to have a great time making season 6. If you can believe it, we're more than halfway done with the season, but there's still some great stuff to come. I really appreciate all of you out there who are listening, and while I know I push the Patreon a lot since I do need to make enough money to keep spending so much time making this show, there are a lot of other ways that you can help Strong Songs succeed. You can leave a review of the show wherever you're listening to it. That really does help people decide to give it a shot. And you can just tell people about the show. If you know anyone who's into music who you think might enjoy Strong Songs, well, the show really does just grow via word of mouth, so don't be shy about spreading the word. All right, it's time for me to go practice guitar because I'm going to need every ounce of chops that I can muster for the next episode after this one. Until then, you know the drill. Thanks for being here. Take care and keep listening.